You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I guess what triggered this particular brown bag and this particular topic were the events in Mumbai a few weeks ago. And those of you who are watching them closely probably have seen a lot of discussions in traditional media about the role that citizen journalism and new media has played in covering the events in Mumbai. And it's not the first time this year that new media has played some role in covering an important news event, particularly an event which was not expected and happened in outside of the sort of developed world. So what I would like to do today is very briefly summarize, for those of you who haven't followed very closely, the role of new media in the events in Mumbai, talk a little bit about the role of new media in covering the war in South Ossetia, speak briefly about Kenya, also very briefly, and the role that new media played there, and try to draw some conclusions about circumstances in which new media works in covering a conflict or an emergency situation, and circumstances in which it doesn't work. So I'll start in the reverse chronological order and start with Mumbai, because it's still very fresh in our memories, at least. Many people have written about it and blogged about it, and some people actually think that Mumbai was the event which established new media and established citizen journalism as an important player in traditional media. There are several activities that took place, which I think I'll just review very briefly. There was a lot of activity on traditional websites like Flickr, where you can share photos of the event, and there have been hundreds of photos which appeared within just a few hours, some of them shot with mobile phones, some of them shot with normal cameras and uploaded immediately. There were, of course, YouTube videos. Wikipedia was very influential in providing a very concise summary of events as they unfolded. This is all traditional stuff which has been happening for the last few years in more or less almost every conflict where there was anybody with a cell phone to cover it. So that was new. What was new with Mumbai, I think, was the role that a particular service called Twitter played in covering the conflict. How many of you know about Twitter? So for those of you who don't, I'll just simply explain what it does. Twitter is basically a microblogging site where all your inputs are limited to 140 characters per post, right? So you can only post 140 characters, right? That's your limit. And the reason why it's limited is because most people get Twitter updates via cell phones, via text messaging, right? So Twitter allows you basically to send one message, and then for all the people who decide to follow you, to receive this message via text messaging, right? So they would get it on their phones. They don't have to be online for that. And Twitter is very popular in some countries, less popular in others. Of course, it depends on how mobile technology works in every country. In some countries, you have to pay for incoming messages. In some countries, you don't have to pay for incoming messages. So this influences the dynamics quite a bit. But Twitter became this major platform during the events in Mumbai, where a lot of people started discussing and posting about what they were seeing with their own eyes on the ground in Mumbai. And at some point, there were more than 80 Twitter messages every 5 seconds relating to Mumbai posted to Twitter. And this is a very significant amount. A lot of messages were sent, right? A lot of messages, some of them from people on the ground in Mumbai, some of the messages from people who were trapped inside a hotel, some of the messages from people who are just sitting, not even in India, sitting in America and just commenting on the events, right? And, the question is, how valuable are they? Could they be used for reporting purposes, right? And some media, of course, very enthusiastically decided that, maybe they should pay a much closer attention to what's going on Twitter, and actually broadcast some of those messages to the wider audience. And of course, some of those messages made a lot of sense. It sort of allowed you to get an inside view onto what the regular sort of, people living in Mumbai who use Twitter on a daily basis think about what happened. So from, anthropological perspective, it was very useful to get a glimpse of what's going on in their heads with regards to the event. Of course, there was some original reporting done on Twitter as well, But there was more disturbingly, I think, a lot of misreporting being done on Twitter, and a lot of misinformation posted on Twitter. There were particularly three cases of misinformation on Twitter. You know, the most prominent one was a supposedly report that the Indian government actually asked bloggers and everyone who's using Twitter to refrain from Twittering because the terrorists were also reading those feeds. You know, so that was, at some point, that was a very widely discussed news item, which actually never happened. The Indian government never asked for that. The Indian government never ordered to stop Twittering. However, somebody posted it on Twitter, it got reposted, and eventually this item appeared in the live report section on the BBC's website, which added even more legitimacy to the news, and then other media picked it up from BBC's website. BBC more or less apologized for carrying this report without verifying it, but they said that it was definitely posted in a special section of our site called Live Reporting, and we never would use this news event for a news story we run on our website. So people had to make a distinction that, you know, it was coming from Twitter and it wasn't the BBC. BBC just highlighted that something was happening. And many people criticized BBC for not being even more straightforward and for, you know, making an even a big apology and saying that they basically didn't verify it and that caused a lot of trouble. There were many other events of misreporting on Twitter, you know, particularly when it comes to what has been attacked and what hasn't been attacked. There was a report at some point that the Marriott Hotel, for example, in Mumbai was also under attack, which it wasn't. And again, somebody posted it because they heard gunshots near Marriott. And again, you know, this information traveled very quickly and, again, misinformed quite a few people who took it seriously. And, again, it got propagated and reported and misreported elsewhere. So to sum up on the use of Twitter in Mumbai, you know, we have seen quite a few interesting accounts from people who already had well-established reputations on Twitter. So people who already had some trust in the new media community and had some visibility in the new media community, happened to provide a very nice perspective. A lot of people who didn't have a reputation for Twittering about Mumbai and about India previously, you know, they were also saying interesting things. It just was very hard and extremely hard to verify whether what they're saying is actually true, whether they are on the ground, or whether they're sitting, you know, in America and just reporting on what they heard elsewhere in the Twitter feed, right? So this is something to keep in mind with Twittering. Again, you have to understand that this depended quite to a big extent to the widespread of mobile phones and to widespread of awareness of Twitter as a platform in India. You know, if you can think of a different event, think of the school siege in Beslan in 2004, and it happened before Twitter. But, you know, the terrorists immediately confiscated all mobile phones, and there was nobody around the school who could actually report anything meaningful because all the activity was happening inside. So whether Twitter was around or whether Twitter wasn't around, you know, at that time, it would still be very hard to get a meaningful perspective from Twitter on what was going on. So this event in Mumbai, I think, shows us that, you know, Twitter and mobile technology in particular can play a significant role, but a lot of other circumstances have to be in place and conditions have to be in place for it to play a meaningful role. You know, another sort of example I would urge you to take a look was, you know, the tsunami in 2004, you know, in Southeast Asia, happened in the same year as Beslan, but, you know, it was a completely different audience, tourists, many of them with mobile phones, taking vacations, you know, sort of text messaging in the pre-Twitter age, and a lot of that information actually trickled down further and appeared in mainstream media, right? You know, a lot of conditions have to be met for it to play a role. You know, in some cases it works, in some cases it doesn't. Of course, the other point you have to keep in mind is that a lot of citizen journalism that happened outside of Twitter still was restricted only to the new media space. It didn't actually, you know, the news didn't get out and they were not carried very widely. I'll give you one example. There is a site called Ground Report, which claims to be a sort of one of the leading platforms of citizen journalism. And they, to their credit, they actually did a good job and they had a very professional looking page for the events in Mumbai much before even the mainstream media started covering it extensively. The problem is that you know, a few hours into the attacks, only 200 people saw it. So, you know, it was very nicely done, but it was still very low traffic. Nobody, you know, very few people saw it as opposed to reports on TV, which were seen by millions of people, right? So, again, we have to be aware of the limited impact that such new media has, as opposed to traditional media, which would be seen by millions. I'll try to contrast it to what happened in Ossetia, which was an entirely, in Georgia, which was an entirely different type of a news story. It wasn't so much an emergency situation. It was, you know, it was a war. There were many other sensitivities involved in it. Political sensitivities, which were not necessarily present in covering the Mumbai conflict, the Mumbai attack. What we basically have seen in the case of Ossetia was that there were very few, there was very little user-generated content, very little. There were a few photos shot supposedly on mobile phones by either party, whether those were Georgian soldiers, whether those were Russian soldiers, whether those were South Ossetians. The number of those photos was pretty much minimal, you know, if it was maybe, you know, 20, 50 at most. Right, and then you have to ask yourself, why did that happen? I think the major reason why is because it was still a region where new media is not necessarily very popular, and there is very little awareness of user-generated content as such. And what we have also seen, unfortunately, in Georgia and Ossetia is that some parties to the conflict actually decided to use new media proactively to argue their own political and ideological line. So new media became very visibly a source of propaganda. You know, I'll give you just a few examples. Even the photos which were provided by the traditional media, by Reuters, became subject to very heated discussions on the Russian blogosphere because people were not sure whether those photos are genuine or whether those photos were staged, particularly from Gori. There was a very gruesome series of photos which basically showed, you know, the level of destruction which wasn't very favorable to the Russian side. It triggered thousands of comments and discussions in the Russian blogosphere. People try to deconstruct whether this may have been staged, whether the people who are being presented as being shot have not necessarily been shot, whether they are all actors. And even the reports from traditional media became subject to such intense speculation that it became almost impossible to trust, you know, what they were depicting. And I'll give you one more example of how such events got content got compromised. What happened also is that at some point in the conflict, supposedly the Echo Moskvy, one of the most popular Russian radio stations, supposedly carried an interview with the photographer of those photos, and he supposedly acknowledged that, you know, it was art. It wasn't really sort of how it happened. He just did it because, you know, they had to depict how bad and sort of how cruel the war is. The interview was a fake, but it took about 5 or 6 hours for mainstream media to contact the station and for the station to denounce the interview as a fake. In these 6 hours, the interview was pretty much posted on all major Russian blogs, and that helped to contribute to this illusion that, you know, the Western media is all against Russia, they're trying to manipulate even how they are depicting the photos and the pictures and the visual evidence of the events. And the reason why I'm focusing on sort of the mainstream media here is that, you know, it's the problem with blogs is that, and with user-generated content, is that it's even harder to trust than reports from the professional media, because in most cases it would be shot by people with a direct ideological or political interest in the conflict. So, you know, whenever Georgians try to post photos which they were shooting with their cell phones on the Russian blogs, the Russians would immediately say, well, how do we know that they are representative of the whole, you know, level of destruction? How do we know that they're representative of, you know, Ossetia? Maybe they're shot in Abkhazia, you know, and all those questions basically create an environment in which you cannot trust anything. And particularly, the more manipulation you see, like this fake interview that, you know, that got posted, the less trust you have in user-generated content. The other thing which was lacking was, of course, the context. You know, it was very hard to again, treat those photos as, you know, it wasn't clear what exactly they were showing, what exactly they were representing. You know, you still needed someone to come in and say, I think that this village is more or less representative of the whole Ossetia, or this house is representative of that region. And normally you would trust a professional reporter to go and, you know, have a survey, look at, you know, investigate when the destruction happened and attach his brand name and attach his agency's brand name to those reports. With new media, that didn't happen, unfortunately. And, you know, now 3 months, 4 months after the war, what we are seeing is actually a resurgence, sort of, you know, a huge increase in this propaganda, particularly with the release of this movie. I don't know how many of you have heard about it. There was a movie released in Russia at the end of October, supposedly shot only from the videos made by cell phones by the Georgian soldiers, and supposedly those cell phones were confiscated then by the Russians and the Ossetians, and then some a particular Russian internet company actually created and produced the whole movie, which is strongly arguing that the Georgians committed atrocities in Ossetia. You know, so, and this is a movie, a piece of ideological material created entirely from user-generated content. Right, so we're seeing a lot of this games post-conflict happening, trying to still argue that, you know, one particular side was responsible or not responsible. And I think the last point I'll make about Georgia is that what we've also seen is that the lack of proper infrastructure, particularly during wartime, and, you know, during wartime in the war zone, makes it very hard for to produce user-generated content. Because what happens is that, you know, very often mobile networks would be down, very often internet would be down, and as we've seen in Georgia, the cyber attacks, you know, regardless of who committed them, the cyber attacks more or less slowed down the Georgian internet up to a point where even if you were making photos with your cell phone, it would still be impossible to distribute them on Georgian blogs and forums because most of them were down. They were not accessible because of cyber attacks. And of course, the more fundamentally, you know, if your electricity is down, it's very hard to charge all of your fancy gadgets as which you can go out and sort of start making those videos and making those photos, right? So, and that of course also happened because electricity was down for long periods of time. So we have to be aware that there are many non-new media related factors and conditions which determine how successfully citizen journalists and bloggers can cover a conflict. The last example I'll give would be the events in Kenya, the post-electoral violence that happened there earlier this year. You know, there was all the traditional stuff that I mentioned at the beginning. There were photos of the conflict, there were of violence, there were videos. All of that got posted by Kenyan bloggers. You know, I won't even go into that territory. I think the most amazing thing that happened was the emergence of this platform called Ushahidi. How many of you know about Ushahidi? So a few. So Ushahidi is this very interesting online platform for documenting. I'll actually cite you how they, well, I'll cite to their premise, but what they do is document violence by soliciting reports which are normally sent through text messaging on particular incidents that are happening in Kenyan towns and Kenyan villages, right? So if there was, you know, robbery, or if there was a rape, or if there was any sort of other violence happening in your particular part of, you know, Nairobi, or, you know, the other towns where the violence was taking place, you could actually text in the type of violence and text in a short description and specify where it's happening. And then this report, after being approved by, you know, a moderator, would be plotted on a Google map. And, you know, eventually they will all be aggregated, so it would be possible to go and see which areas are more dangerous than others. So essentially it became a tool which allowed people who wanted to check which are safe areas and which are more dangerous areas to go to. They could actually go and see, you know, which areas they should avoid, which areas they should sort of stay away from. Of course, it also helped to document some of the violence that was taking place. Ushahidi, I think, means testimony in Swahili, right? So that was the philosophy behind it. It turned out to be a very valuable tool, and not just for Kenya. So what they did was later expand and create an open, they rebuilt the whole platform, made it open source, and now you can actually go and deploy it in every other country that you want to deploy it in. You know, you can deploy it for any conflict, for anything. You know, the assumption, again, is simple. People will be sending messages, messages would be analyzed, and then the type of information they contain would be posted on some sort of an online map. There are a few questions here. I mean, the basic question is how much news value and trust value does it provide as opposed to simply documenting violence? I mean, it's nice as a tool, a useful tool of seeing, you know, which areas of town you should avoid. It's very hard to make an argument that you can build a credible news story or you can make a credible conclusion as to the level of violence and the type of the attacks happening, you know, in the country. So I think some Kenyan journalists definitely took advantage of it by identifying, interesting quotation marks incidents and following up and then doing professional radio stories and professional, you know, news stories about it. I think it would be very hard for, you know, somebody like BBC or CNN to rely on this tool to draw a conclusive picture of what's happening on the ground, right? So there are different, values and levels of usefulness with a tool like Ushahidi. What also happened with Ushahidi is because they open sourced it, and now it can be used in any other conflict. It has been deployed in DRC to document the recent violence in DRC in Congo. And it hasn't, despite a lot of, you know, new media busts and old media busts that they got, that just got featured in BBC, there was a big story in Forbes about them, it still hasn't worked as well as they hoped. And there was a very interesting blog post by one of the founders last week, which basically tried to explain why Ushahidi may not have worked in DRC as successfully as it worked in Kenya. And basically, I'll just run you through a few of the reasons that she gave. And she basically, one of the reasons was that there are the incentives for reporting violence, particularly during a very violent situation, are not exactly clear. I mean, if you're really in a very troubled situation, you know, you'll probably want to flee first and then report second. So, plus there are all sorts of concerns about privacy, about, you know, what can happen to you as a result of that report. So it's not yet clear why somebody would want to report on an incident they're seeing if their own life is in danger, right? So this is one aspect. Maybe the conflict dynamics in Kenya were different, and that's why it was a bit easier to do it in Kenya. The other thing which she mentions is that, again, during a particularly violent conflict, maybe very hard to buy a phone credit, because you still need your phone to be operational to report the conflict. And if you can't buy, you know, if you can't charge up credit on your phone, you're pretty much left out of this reporting cycle, right? So in Kenya, the situation was slightly different because there are sites like Mama Mike's, for example, which allow you to actually donate money to a specific number via the internet. So, for example, the Kenyan diaspora would often help to charge up credit on top up credit on the mobile phones virtually without having anything to do with finding a kiosk to buy, you know, a new sort of a new card to top up your credit. Charging mobile phones was also a problem. You know, when you are in a very violent situation and you are on the run all the time, you know, you can't just charge it. So it's sort of not your top priority. I think what she also singled out was that there is no previous history. I shouldn't say that there is no history. There is sort of a data request fatigue among a lot of NGOs and sort of activists working in DRC because they are being requested to provide all sorts of data on a regular basis, you know, by other more traditional organizations, and they are yet to see a genuine benefit of doing this. So, you know, for many of them, it's a very sort of, it's another request to provide another sort of data, and they have had sort of previous experiences which were not probably very rewarding on this front. And of course, the biggest reason that, you know, Ushahidi's development team outlined was that they couldn't secure buy-in from the local bloggers in DRC. you know, some of them seemed very enthusiastic, but very few of them actually took the step and blogged about it or tried to sort of help promote it with their friends and with their own communities. And in Kenya, the situation was radically different because the people who set it up in Kenya were pretty much the leading bloggers and the leading new media enthusiasts in Kenya. You know, so it was very easy for them to build momentum behind Ushahidi because they were all prominent and they could easily rally sort of, you know, huge crowds behind Ushahidi. So, and that's more or less also the problem we saw in Ossetia, because the new media scene in Ossetia was pretty much non-existent. There were three or four bloggers who were blogging for LiveJournal, but everything else, you know, it wasn't really, it wasn't as vibrant as it is in Russia, for example. And, you know, and in Georgia itself, it is quite vibrant in Tbilisi, but it's not vibrant at all in smaller towns like Gori, for example. So a lot depends on what kind of new media infrastructure. And here I'm talking really about specific bloggers and specific sort of enthusiasts who can build up a case for a platform like Ushahidi. It just didn't happen in DRC. So those were the three cases I wanted to focus on. I'll just sort of throw out a few questions, which I think we can discuss after I finish, and also give one interesting illustration of how citizen journalism and new media can actually lead to quite significant and tangible bad consequences. And I'll actually do it now. I mean, some of you may have seen reports from, I think, October when, iReport, CNN's website, at some point reported that Steve Jobs was in an emergency room with, I think, a stroke or heart attack. And they actually, the person who submitted that report said, "I see Steve Jobs being carried into this emergency room. It's horrible, you know, blah, blah, blah." And they submitted it to CNN, to iReport section of CNN at least, from where this information traveled very widely around the tech blogosphere and eventually caused a very significant drop in Apple stock prices. So Apple stock dropped significantly in one day by a very significant share, right? So this is one example. I'll give you another example. And again, that just shows you how, not being able to verify what citizen journalists are producing can actually lead to very significant tangible consequences. Another example which I have is also from, you know, more or less three months ago from September, when Google News... by not actually their mistake, but they indexed a story which they already indexed in 2002 about a sudden decline in the stock of United Airlines stock, right? So they actually indexed a story which they already indexed in 2002 because the source of the story somehow didn't update their website properly, right? So Google News suddenly publishes a story from 2002 but with 2008 date, saying that there has been a tremendous drop in United Airlines stock prices. The story from Google News makes it to a newsletter on Bloomberg and ends up in all sort of important offices on Wall Street and elsewhere. And Google News reported becomes true because everybody tries to get rid of United Airlines stock, and there is again a significant drop in stock prices, right? So that's just to illustrate how automation without proper verification can also lead to very tangible negative consequences. And the questions that I would like to raise, which we can discuss now, are, do the costs of verification of all of this information provided by citizen journalists, do they actually outweigh the benefits of aggregating all of it, right? So do we actually gain anything by spending so much time to verify whether it's actually truthful, or do we just actually, you know, lose something in the process? Another question which I think is very relevant is, you know, we may say that Twitter is a very fine service, but those of us who follow new media pretty much know that there is still no business model behind Twitter. So Twitter still hasn't been able to come up with a way to monetize their activities, and they're basically right now being subsidized by, you know, venture capitalist money. Right? So the question is, if we do think that Twitter would be an important replacement or an important add-on to traditional media, the question is who will pay for it? Because right now we may be seeing this renaissance of social media, but, you know, it's quite obvious who's paying for this renaissance. Those are venture capitalists in California and not sort of the companies themselves. So again, there is a very interesting question of sustainability. And I think another question, probably the last one, which I think is very interesting, is what are the types of conditions in which blogs and new media can help to cover conflict and or an emergency situation? And what are the types of conditions where neither blogs nor new media can't add much? You know, because as we've seen with South Ossetia, for example, there was very little that blogs could add. Not because there was not enough information, but because everyone tended to distrust it, no matter how, you know, colorful or how descriptive it is, because you don't know what the source is, and you don't know whether this particular blogger is being paid by the government, or whether he's being paid by the security services, or he's being paid by someone else, right? So that didn't seem to happen to this extent in the case of Mumbai, because there didn't seem to be enough motivation for anyone to want to misreport it deliberately, unless they were really working for the terrorists and wanted to mislead the police efforts, right? So I think it's very important to try to sort of flesh out what are the conditions in which it would work and in which we can trust new media and citizen journalists to do this reporting job properly, and what are the conditions in which that would be entirely unrealistic. So I think I'll stop here.
Yevgeny, thank you so much.